Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is Monday, March 21st. The time is approximately 1:12 PM. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Kelsey Riker from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we currently have Representative Drummond and myself, Representative Klayman. We are not required to have a quorum to conduct business today. I would expect because the House floor ran a little bit late. Later than normal, we will have some come in as we proceed. But our first order of business today is a presentation on the case of Belleville versus Dunleavy. We are joined today via video conference by Richard Frankel, Professor of Law and Director of the Civil Litigation and Dispute Resolution Concentration, Drexel University, Thomas R. Klein School of Law. If you want to please identify yourself for the record and you begin your remarks. I'll also remind committee members to do your best to save your questions for the end of his remarks. Mr. Frankel.
Chairman Klayman, honorable members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to participate in this hearing this afternoon. My purpose here is to give some background and context around the federal civil rights statute 42 U.S.C. 1983, which formed the basis for the lawsuit in the case of Belleville versus Dunleavy. By way of background, as you mentioned, I'm a professor of law at the Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law in Philadelphia. In that capacity, I have studied and written articles about Section 1983, and I have also been involved in Section 1983 litigation in various capacities. In addition, I teach civil procedure, and so I'm familiar with how lawsuits proceed through the federal system. I do want to caution that I do not consider myself an expert with respect to the First Amendment in particular, which is one of the substantive issues in this case, though I do have some knowledge. And while I've looked at publicly available documents regarding the Belleville case, I'm certainly not as intimately familiar with it as the parties or as Judge Sedgwick. The Section 1983 statute allows lawsuits when a person acting under color of state law, usually a government employee, violates someone's federal constitutional or statutory rights. This provision was enacted in 1871 as part of a series of civil rights statutes passed during Reconstruction to protect citizens following the Civil War. It was enacted to create a form of tort liability against state actors when they violated federal rights, including liability for damages. The goals of the statute are similar to other torts: to compensate victims and deter future misconduct. Because Section 1983 provides a cause of action for any violation of the Constitution, it has a relatively broad reach. Although we may think of the most common types of cases, such as allegations of excessive force by police officers or unconstitutional conditions of confinement in correctional facilities, the statute covers a number of other claims as well, including substantive and procedural due process, takings claims under the Constitution, and of relevance here, First Amendment claims. While those may be a bit less common than Fourth Amendment excessive force claims or prisoner civil rights claims, the U.S. Supreme Court and the lower federal courts have developed a relatively detailed doctrine around the rights of public employees not to be dismissed or face adverse employment actions on account of their speech or their political views. I'll address that a bit more in a moment, but first I want to give a little background about some of the doctrine relating to Section 1983 and about how one brings a Section 1983 lawsuit. The statute allows suits against state officials. These state officials can be sued in their official capacity as well as in their individual capacity. And there were various common law immunities against government officials that existed at the time the statute was enacted and that were incorporated into the statute. So, which I will proceed to talk about. Section 1983 plaintiffs typically can seek both injunctive relief and damages relief. Injunctive relief is prospective, forward-looking relief. Right, if there's an unconstitutional policy in place, it would prevent the policy from being utilized or bar it from going into effect. Damages relief is backwards-looking relief, providing compensation to plaintiffs who were injured by an unconstitutional act. First Amendment employment cases commonly give rise to damages claims, just as other employment law claims do, because if plaintiffs lose their jobs or not hired for a job or suffer adverse employment consequences, these often cause harm for which they might be entitled to damages. Under Section 1983, there are two types of immunities that are common for damages claims. The first is 11th Amendment or state sovereign immunity, which says that a state is immune from damages unless that state consents to damages or Congress explicitly abrogates that immunity. A claim against a state employment in that employee's official capacity, including a claim against the governor in the governor's official capacity, is treated under the law as a claim against the state itself. Therefore, that type of damages claim against an employee in their official capacity is barred by 11th Amendment immunity.
We're going to take a very short pause to recognize Representative Eastman joined us at 1:18. Please proceed.
Oh, good afternoon. I was talking about 11th Amendment immunity. So on the other hand, the 11th Amendment does not bar a damages claim against a state actor in their individual capacity. The general idea for this is that a state official is not authorized to act in violation of federal law or the Constitution, so such damages claims should be allowed, right? So, you know, if I'm sued for actions taken in the context of my job, right, and I'm found liable, I can be personally liable for the judgment. The rule is no different for government officials, except in one way. Unlike private individuals sued for ordinary torts, a state official sued in their individual capacity under Section 1983 may still be protected by what is called qualified immunity. The thrust of this doctrine is that an individual is protected from damages unless their actions violated clearly established law. In other words, if they had a reasonable basis to believe that their actions were lawful, then they would be protected. I think the idea is that we don't want government actors to be unduly timid in carrying out their duties, so they should only be liable if they really should have known that their actions were unlawful. In recent years, the qualified immunity doctrine has become somewhat controversial. There have been proposals in U.S. Congress to get rid of qualified immunity. Various states have proposed legislation to try to minimize it. The doctrine still exists under Section 1983, but it certainly has been debated. In Belleville, as you know, Judge Sedgwick, relying on several cases, held that it was clearly established that it violates the First Amendment to require non-policy-making employees to signal commitment to their supervisor's political views as a condition of keeping their jobs. So that's a framework for Section 1983 and how to bring lawsuits under that. I would like to turn now to address a couple aspects of the Belleville case that at first blush may look unusual, but in fact may not be that unusual. First, it may initially seem interesting that the court here granted summary judgment for the plaintiffs, meaning that he ruled for the plaintiffs without holding a trial. Summary judgment is a very common procedural device that can be used by either plaintiffs or defendants when there are no material facts in dispute, and the only question is whether the facts violate the law. In other words, because the purpose of a jury trial ordinarily is to determine facts, when everyone agrees on what the facts are, a trial is unnecessary and the judge can rule on the law. Some types of Section 1983 cases are unlikely to be decided for a plaintiff at the summary judgment stage short of trial because they typically involve disputed facts. In a police excessive force case, for example, there's likely to be a factual dispute about what happened, with the plaintiff and the police presenting different versions of the events at hand. And in that kind of case, you would deny summary judgment and it would be up to the jury to decide which version of the facts to believe. But for other types of cases, particularly challenges to statutes or to executive branch policies, where everyone agrees about what the policy is, and the only question is the policy's legal significance, is it legal or illegal, it can be perfectly appropriate to decide that kind of case on summary judgment. And the Belleville case appears like it could be that kind of case. I looked at some of the filings in the case. And what I noticed is that both sides sought summary judgment in their own favor. In other words, both sides argued that the facts were not in dispute, but that the law favored their side of the case. Neither side argued that the facts were in dispute and the case needed to go to trial to resolve a factual dispute. Given that posture, it made sense for the district court to decide the case on summary judgment one way or the other based on the court's reading of the law. And while I want to say again that I'm not a First Amendment expert, it's certainly not unheard of, even if it's not as common, for a district court to decide that kind of claim at the summary judgment stage. Similarly, it's not uncommon to find at summary judgment that a defendant should not receive qualified immunity. If the law is really clearly established and there's no dispute about the facts, then just as with the merits, the court should decide the qualified immunity question at summary judgment. And that's what Judge Sedgwick did here. He found that both the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, whose case law governed the District of Alaska, had issued several decisions showing that a state official cannot condition employment of non-policymaking employees based on their political support or political beliefs. And in doing a little research for this hearing, I came across other cases, a few in which state employees were awarded damages when they suffered employment consequences in violation of their First Amendment rights. It is worth noting, though, that even where damages are awarded, it doesn't mean that payment is coming out of the employee's own pocket. For a lot of employees, particularly for sort of police officers, correctional officers, it's very common to be indemnified by the state or the municipality for any damages award, absent a finding of intentional misconduct or an award of punitive damages. It is worth noting, I think, that a number of legal scholars have strongly criticized indemnification practices, arguing that they are overused and too broad, and that as a result, some damages awards fail to actually deter misconduct because the employees know they will be protected even if they violate clearly established constitutional principles. Finally, it may seem unusual that damages were awarded against the sitting governor of a state. But it's also worth noting that governors are state actors who can be sued under Section 1983 just like any other state actor. Who the defendant is really just depends on where the hiring decision or the employment policy comes from. If it comes from a sub-office, like the sheriff's department, then often the sheriff would be the appropriate defendant. But if the policy comes from the governor's office, then the governor is an appropriate defendant. And in fact, one of the major Supreme Court cases in this field involves an action by a governor that some might say looks similar to the actions in the Belleville case. That case, called Rutan versus Republican Party of Illinois, involved a newly elected governor of Illinois who instituted a hiring freeze and said that state employees could not be hired or promoted without his permission. And then he created an office to evaluate hiring and made decisions based on who supported the Republican Party. The court held that the governor's actions amounted to a patronage system that violated the First Amendment. And since then, there have been other examples involving governors from all different parties, even if those types of cases may be less frequent than some other types of Section 1983 cases that we see more often. One thing that I found interesting and what may be more unusual, though I'm sure it must have come up before, and again, it's not something that I'm expert in, is how the executive branch decides whether to indemnify a sitting governor as opposed to another state employee. It looks like from the documents here, the decision about whether to indemnify comes from the attorney general, who is an appointee of the governor. And here, the Attorney General's office has seemed to conclude that the governor should be indemnified because he did not engage in any willful misconduct. And again, while I'm not an expert in this case, if there's reason to believe that the governor knew that the kind of hiring system cited institute was unconstitutional and did it anyway, that could be thought of as intentional misconduct. And the fact that the decision rests with someone who serves at the pleasure of the governor, is something that in theory could create an appearance of a conflict of interest, at least, even if not an actual conflict of interest in a particular case. But again, this is not something that I have exhaustively researched. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to provide some information about Section 1983 and its application to the Belleville case. I would be happy to answer any questions that the committee members have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I see that Representative Snyder joined us at 1:27 p.m. And we are open for questions from the committee for Mr. Franklin. I'll ask a question. I see Representative Eastman, you look like you're pondering the question. So, Professor Frankel, you talked a little earlier about the distinction between, in a case like Belleville, the request for injunctive relief versus the damages. And can you provide a little more background about how the suit against the state is only seeking injunctive or moving forward prospective relief, whereas the damages claim against the governor and his chief of staff are for retrospective relief for past actions, and how that fits in the both the Section 1983 but also 11th Amendment factors?
Right. I guess based on the facts of the case, the plaintiffs could seek both damages and injunctive relief. It's just a question of what type of relief is available with respect to each defendant. So as I mentioned, under the 11th Amendment, a state is immune from damages relief, except for when particular exceptions apply. But they are not immune from injunctive relief. So you could sue the state to seek a declaration that the governor's policy is unconstitutional and to get an injunction preventing it from being implemented or barring it if it's already been implemented, if particular conditions are met. And then separately from that, right, if you've suffered actual damages, you can also seek damages as compensation. You can't get those from the state, but you can get those from state employees acting in their, you can get those from state employees as long as those state employees are not entitled to qualified immunity from damages.
So for purposes of this suit, the options that the plaintiff had was essentially getting an order from the state, because this had happened in the past, don't do it again, or if there's a policy that's going to try to do it again, the policy can't enforce the policy, but the order to the state is don't do it again, whereas in terms of the governor, that's if there's no immunity applied, then the governor potentially has to pay the damages, but there's no scenario in which the state would have to pay for past damages because of the state's 11th Amendment protection.
That's right. The only way to do it, I guess, is if the state waives sovereign immunity in a particular context. But you're right. Otherwise, they would not be subject to damages under Section 1983, the state itself.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And I'll admit I'm not an expert in this case or the details. I am curious, though, through the chair, if the policy is somewhat dated. I think the policy was put out, you know, some years ago, and I don't know that it's been renewed. Is there, I guess, what would be the difference between action the petitioners might take now as opposed to, you know, after the next election, if the administration or a new administration, you know, puts forward that type of policy again? What options do they have under the current setting right now today versus a year from now a new administration, you know, tries to do the same thing?
And just to clarify, when you say the petitioners, you mean the particular plaintiffs in this, Belleville lawsuit?
Today it would be the petitioners for today. Next year it might be somebody else, but same idea.
Right. So the petitioners and the plaintiffs in the Belleville case, I guess, have reached a settlement. And so their case has been dismissed. So they would not be able to, they can't later file a suit seeking damages based on the previous decision, by the governor, because they've already filed suit. If a new policy were issued by a new governor, I guess that would have to be evaluated based on the specifics of that policy to determine its constitutionality. And someone who is injured by that policy would have the right to file suit challenging that one.
Follow.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. And if... The settlement, to the extent that you're aware of the details, do you know, is the settlement that was agreed upon, is that contingent upon some type of legislative action? I mean, if the legislature does nothing, does that moot the settlement and then create a new cause for action, or what would that do?
I think that's a legal question for the court to decide, but it looks like what happened was the settlement was made contingent. The payment was made contingent upon a legislative appropriation, but the parties agreed to the settlement and then the case got dismissed. So the case has been dismissed. And I think irrespective of whether that appropriation is made, I think those plaintiffs would be precluded from filing a subsequent suit if the appropriation is not made based on sort of, common law doctrines were of claim preclusion. And then, to be honest, I don't know what power the legislature has to sort of confer. I'm talking about sort of traditional principles, but it's maybe the legislature has the power to confer a new cause of action to override the common law doctrine of claim preclusion to provide an additional cause of action. But I don't know how that would operate, and I don't know how that would operate with a federal cause of action. So I'm reluctant to say that would be an option.
Thank you.
There was a decision that the court also made at roughly the same time in the Bacalar matter against the governor. And in that case, the court denied summary judgment to Bacalar at roughly the same time. I mean, I don't know if it's exactly the same dates, but we distributed both opinions to the committee. How do you distinguish the Bacalar case where there's no liability against the governor from the Belleville case where there is liability against the governor?
So that comes down to, I think, what's sort of known as the policymaking exception in this line of cases. So the court has recognized that a newly elected official should have the right to select certain high level employees, and that you want them to be, it's okay to want them to be on the same political page as you because they're high level policy making officials. So if someone's considered a policy making official, this First Amendment political patronage doctrine doesn't apply in the same way. The same kind of demanding the sort of, I guess, wanting an expression of loyalty or commitment to the governor's political agenda wouldn't violate the First Amendment in the same way. So in the Belleville case, Judge Sedgwick found that the two plaintiffs at issue, there was no dispute in Judge Sedgwick's mind that they did not qualify as policymaking officials. And so they could not be dismissed based on their political views or their failure to express approval with the governor's political agenda. On the other hand, in the Bacalar case, the court found that government attorneys have typically been considered to be policymaking authority under the law. And what Judge Sedgwick said is that it may be the case that this particular attorney did not have policymaking authority under the facts of the case, but it wasn't clearly established law at the time. There weren't really cases on point finding that an attorney, firing an attorney would violate the First Amendment. And so in that case, the court said that the governor should receive qualified immunity for the decision because it wasn't clearly established that firing or not rehiring, however you want to phrase it, that particular employee would violate the First Amendment.
Representative, I see you in the queue, but I'm just going to have one follow-up on this. So one of the distinctions being Bacalar is a senior lawyer at the Department of Law, Attorney General's office, where the Belleville and the other doctor are both senior psychiatrists at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, but neither of the doctors is really asked to implement policy where there's some question that Bacalar may actually be asked to implement the governor's policies.
Yeah, that's how I understand it from looking at the cases, that essentially the two plaintiffs in Belleville are clinicians, and they are making, right, they're treating patients and making medical decisions, but they're not enacting government policy.
And
Boxler, by contrast, may have been, or at least it wasn't clearly established that someone in her position was not.
Does that mean in Bacalar's case that she has a claim against the government for injunctive or prospective relief, whereas she loses her claim against the governor for damages as a result of the summary judgment decision, or is that an open question for trial in Bacalar?
So I have to go back and look at the way the case was filed and what relief she's seeking. And so there are other limitations on how one seeks injunctive relief. So if she had said, I'm not going to seek government, you know, I don't want to seek a job in this administration, so I'm unlikely to apply again, then she wouldn't receive injunctive relief because the court would say, well, there's not a risk of this happening again, so you don't need an injunction against it. So in other words, there's various standing doctrines and other doctrines that might come into play that may affect the availability of injunctive relief without necessarily regard to the underlying legality or illegality of the policy.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And you mentioned in the Bacalar case that at that time the court found that the facts weren't clearly established, or at least the doctrine wasn't clearly established. Has that changed since that time? You know, if that case were to be brought forward, you know, with a, you know, similar fact pattern, brand new next year, would the court look at it differently?
So I'd have to go back and look at the decision a little more closely before I gave you a firm answer, but not necessarily. Usually courts are looking for examples from higher courts, either say the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals or the U.S. Supreme Court, to develop that clearly established law. Because it essentially what you're trying to do is say you're now on notice that this kind of action, this kind of conduct is illegal, or you should be on notice that there's been something sufficiently similar that you should know better. And, you know, I think it's debatable. Maybe Judge Sedgwick wrote his opinion in a way that says, look, this was violated the First Amendment because she was not, Bacalar is not a policymaking official. But I hadn't found a case clearly on point. Now there's a case on point, mine. So if you come back, you might not get qualified immunity. I haven't seen that many examples like that before. Usually they're looking for a higher level decision. Now I can't be sure, right? A creative lawyer, you know, a good lawyer could argue it both ways, and then it would have to get litigated. And again, it wouldn't provide a basis for Ms. Bacalar's claim because she's already brought suit, so she can't bring a second suit.
Thank you.
You had talked earlier about seeing I think it was the Rutan case from Illinois involving the governor. Is it common to see 1983 cases brought against the sitting governor? Or is that in the broad landscape of these cases, is it much more often police officers and corrections officers and supervisors in those departments, but rarely the governor, at least in the broad lineup of these kinds of cases?
Yeah, I think that's right. Just by virtue of like how many police officers there may be in any given state relative to how many governors there's going to be in a given state, right? And just the number of interactions that might lead to a constitutional claim, that overall, I think you're more often likely to see Section 1983 claims against different types of defendants. That said, there have been, like in the Rutan case, there have been other cases too where governors have made similar types of hiring freezes or hiring-based decisions and have been sued as a result of it. But I would say it's less it's definitely less common than what you more often see in Section 1983 cases.
The other thing, and you weren't obviously at the hearing, but I was asking the Attorney General about when she was talking about the proposed settlement, about the frequency that governors them are actually found liable on summary judgment. It's kind of been my impression that your common decision on summary judgment is more often similar to the Bacalar case, where the court's finding that there is qualified immunity because there's the law isn't clear and the facts are in dispute. And so it's more often than not that summary judgment is denying liability against the governor rather than finding liability. And what's your sense in terms of those cases that get to summary judgment?
Yeah, that's my sense in terms of Section 1983 overall, and probably for the first amendment cases too. I think defendants more often win at summary judgment than plaintiffs do, just as a general matter. And that courts are more inclined to, if it's on the plaintiff's side, deny summary judgment and let the case go to trial. I think of the cases I've seen, there's been sort of a mix, but, you know, if there's a dispute about whether someone's a policymaking official, that would be a reason maybe to send the case to trial or deny summary judgment. And it may be that other governors' policies were a little more tailored than this policy. So they really tried to limit it to a smaller class of employees. Or there were certain disputes about whether those employees were policymaking officials. That's where I've seen a lot of the cases get hung up, as opposed to kind of the nature of the, I guess, the hiring decision made by the governor. So I would say it's relatively, this kind of ruling is relatively uncommon in this kind of case based on what I've seen.
So in terms of at the time of the settlement in the Belleville case, there'd been a summary judgment motion finding the governor personally liable, and that finding had been appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and there was a settlement while it was before the Ninth Circuit. I know this is a hypothetical scenario, but had the parties not reached a settlement and it had gone forward to the Ninth Circuit, I suppose if the Ninth Circuit agreed with Judge Sedgwick, then that would be the end of it, and the governor would still be liable. If the Ninth Circuit reversed and said that Judge Sedgwick was wrong, what would be the next step? Would that mean it would come back and the plaintiffs would have to try the case to see that question? Or, I mean, what does it look like if the Ninth Circuit disagrees with Judge Sedgwick on the summary judgment question?
It would really depend on the why. So if it seems like one of the disputes between the parties was about the, you know, whether the two plaintiffs should be considered policymaking officials. So if the Ninth Circuit found as a matter of law that they were policymaking officials, I guess the right approach there would be to order Judge Sedgwick to grant summary judgment to the defendants on the grounds that the First Amendment didn't apply to the case. If the reasoning was that there was a factual dispute about either the nature of the policy or a factual dispute about their policymaking status, then they might say you should go ahead and have a trial. So I think it would have depended on what the decision turned on.
In your work, both as you run a legal clinic, do you sometimes look at bringing 1983 lawsuits in work with the students in the legal clinic that you supervise?
So we have in the past, both as appeals and sometimes in federal district court. A lot of them have tended to involve prisoner civil rights claims in one form or another. We've also done some involving police misconduct. So that is an area that we have done in the past, although not as much in the last couple of years.
What are some of the strategy things you look at in terms about whether or not to bring a claim or not bring a claim when you're – sounds like you're bringing these on the plaintiff's side and not the defendant's side. What are the strategy things you look at in deciding whether or not to bring the claim?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. And as a legal clinic, you know, I mean, we're always looking as, you know, you never want to – so, you know, ethically, right, you're ethically bound to only file a suit that you have a reasonable basis to file. right? And you have to affirm under the rules of civil procedure that you've done reasonable investigation and you believe that there's a basis for the claims that you're filing. So the first strategy is to make sure that there's a, you know, you think there's a reasonable basis to say there's a there, rather. And that something unfair has happened or illegal has happened. And then from there, you know, investigating possible options, looking at the strength and the weakness of the case, looking at, you know, there are other examples of defendant's behavior in similar circumstances, the possibility that, you know, and then sort of what the client's goals are, right, for bringing that kind of case. So if the case is going to be a long, dragged out case, is the client comfortable going through that? Or maybe there's a, you know, other ways to resolve the client's concerns, short of litigation. I think there's a variety of factors, but mostly you're looking at how strong is the claim and what do you think the likelihood of success is?
What about if you win a jet damage award, the collectability, whether somebody will actually be able to pay if you win, is that a factor that goes into your strategy or is not, you're in this kind of unique place where you're a law school?
As a legal clinic, a little less so because we're not charging our clients. So we're not like a, you know, contingency fee, right? We are operating, within the realm of, you know, student practice rules that courts have special student practice rules that allow law students in clinics to represent clients. But to do so, typically we're providing pro bono services to people who cannot afford a lawyer and we're not charging them for our services. So we have a little more flexibility to bring certain kinds of cases, maybe where there was a, you know, a significant wrong, but it may be harder to recover damages, because we don't depend on it in the same way. So, as a law clinic, we have a slightly different, I guess, categorization, but I will say going back to the indemnification point that I mentioned, the possibility of damages not being paid out at all is relatively unlikely in part, because most defendants are indemnified by their municipality, their state. I haven't seen situations like this where in Pennsylvania, I don't think you have to get an appropriation as to a particular settlement. Rather, they'd have to pay it out of their general fund. Or if you get a judgment as opposed to a settlement, you can go ahead and enforce it. It's up to the state to figure out where the money's going to come from. So that's not the situation like here is not something that I've personally faced before.
Okay, I want to add other questions from committee members. I think the only other area that I had a couple of questions about is in the cases that you had in the clinic, were there instances in which individuals were found personally liable for past misconduct or past constitutional violations as opposed to just getting injunctive relief for future behavior?
Yes. Yeah, that's happened. We've been involved in some cases either where there were appeals of those, where there were damages awards. So there have been some. There have been some that we ultimately settled short of trial. There were some that we addressed on appeal and got the case reinstated, but maybe it didn't go all the way to judgment after that. So there's definitely been a mix of types of cases in that respect.
And when you've had damage awards, sounds like on all the cases you've had, even though the defendant is personally liable, your understanding is always the governmental body would always end up paying the damages and it wasn't being paid by the person individually.
Yes, we didn't necessarily think about where, I guess when you're representing the plaintiff, I wasn't necessarily thinking about where the money was coming from. My obligation to the client was to see that the client got the payment. And if the defendant wanted to sort of figure out how it was going to happen, whether the state was going to pay it out and then seek contribution from the employee or whether they were not going to indemnify or anything like that. You know, that we didn't really involve ourselves in that unless it was going to affect the ability to pay. I guess I didn't think about that question quite so much. I just assumed in most cases it would come from the state or the municipality. In some cases, it was the municipality rather than the state.
I see Representative Christ Tompkins joined us by phone at 1:49 p.m. Representative Christ Tompkins, did you have any questions for Professor Frankel?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair, but thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from members of the committee? Representative Eastman,
I think the answer is going to be I don't know or very quick. I just wanted to offer, since the legislature is currently looking at you know, our part in the appropriation process, as you've looked at the case, is there, you know, if the legislature does or doesn't do something, is there a scenario where you think that would create a cause of action from anyone? I know we talked about the fact that the previous case has been settled, so maybe that isn't really an option, but it is, as you see it, is does the legislature sort of have, you know, the constitutional authority to do whatever it wants in this topic, or is there a legal argument that you know, we have less discretion than some think we do?
Oh, that's I think you were correct in your prediction of what my answer would be. I don't know. My guess would be that you have discretion. I don't think that the settling parties can bind the legislature as to how it acts as a coordinate branch of government. But not only am I not an expert on First Amendment, I'm certainly not an expert on sort of Alaska constitutional structure, and I'd be reluctant to hazard a guess on that question.
Sure. No, well, thank you for the answer all the same.
I suppose on that question, if it was a judgment, I think we talked about that at one of the hearings, if it was a trial court judgment and we declined to pay, then interest would accumulate. But in this instance, because this is a settlement and it's contingent on legislative funding, I'm not sure they'd even have an argument if we paid it 5 years from now, whether interest would have accumulated or not, because it's a settlement and there's no interest provisions. Okay. Well, unless others have other questions, I want to thank Professor Frankel for taking the time to come and make a presentation, and I will give committee members, if they'd like to make any final comments before we sign off for the day, and those comments may actually lead to some further discussion. But Representative Christ Tompkins, any closing comments or observations?
None for me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Snyder?
No, Mr. Chair, just thank you for coordinating this presentation so far.
And Representative Drummond?
No comments, but I'm glad you did this. I learned quite a bit. Thanks.
Representative Eastman?
Yes, thank you very much for coming. Very much appreciate the opportunity to hear your perspective on these topics.
Thank you very much.
And I want to thank Professor Frankel for taking the time to research these issues and bring his expertise and knowledge in terms of both 1983 actions and some degrees of federal civil procedure to our committee that I think will help the legislature have a better understanding of some of the issues we have to address on whether or not to appropriate funds as requested by the governor. So thank you very much. With that, we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Wednesday, March 23rd at 1 p.m. The time is now 1:57 p.m. and we are adjourned.